Happy New Year, and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today, we're reading from vanityfair.com. We've got a lot of current events, and of course, we've got to check in on politics in this new year. We are going to start with a memoriam. I'm sure you've heard that former President Jimmy Carter died at age 100. This article is by Michael Kinsley, published on December 29th. Jimmy Carter left office in 1981, one of the least popular U.S. presidents ever. He died Sunday at the age of 100, according to his son, James E. Carter III, as one of the most popular ex-presidents ever. Indeed, he redefined the role. Carter's predecessor, the never actually elected Gerald Ford, was Exhibit A of the previous model of ex-presidency, which had three components: giving speeches around the world, associating yourself in some way with uncontroversial charities, and playing golf. Carter did not have time for golf. He was too busy improving the world. This is not to say that Jimmy Carter, as president, did not improve the world. He did, in spades. He facilitated negotiations between Egypt's president, Anwar Sadat, and Israel's prime minister, Menachem Begin, at Camp David, the presidential retreat, where the two leaders reached an agreement that established the framework for the first peace treaty between the Arab country and the Jewish state. He oversaw the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, or the SALT II, with Russia, the implementation of active, ongoing diplomacy with China, and the pivotal Panama Canal Treaty. At home, he managed to triple the size of America's protected wilderness areas and establish two new governmental agencies, the Department of Energy and the Department of Education. No mean feats, and good works all. Indeed, he died with a reputation for decency and for good works, largely channeled through the Carter Center, based in Atlanta, achieving watersheds that no former or subsequent president has. He worked tirelessly with his wife, Rosalyn, whom he married in 1946, on myriad projects, most notably their transformative partnership with Habitat for Humanity. Each year, the couple literally rolled up their sleeves and helped build affordable housing, often for the underserved in impoverished or climate-ravaged communities. He started an initiative focused on election observation, monitoring ballot box integrity in attempts to ensure free and fair elections around the world. He worked to prevent life-threatening diseases such as guinea worm and malaria. And in 2002, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to find peaceful solutions to international conflicts, to advance democracy and human rights, and to promote economic and social development. Carter's formula has since become the gold standard for ex-presidents. Here's what you need. First, build a museum or library where the ex-president's memorabilia and archives are protected from the elements for all time, and where tourists may go and teach their children about the great man's greatness. Second, if possible, create a center or institute that's actually just a front for the ex-president's efforts to address issues on all fronts, war, public health, and so on, through personal intervention. Third, write a passel of books. Carter penned 32. And fourth, set up a program for appointing fellowships and staging conferences about, oh, the presidency, say, or bipartisanship, or something of that order. In short, Jimmy Carter invented the role of the ex-president as a global busybody. When he ran for president in 1976 as a Navy lieutenant cum peanut farmer cum former governor of Georgia, James Earl Jimmy Carter Jr., a man of deep faith and ethical fortitude, was widely mocked for his hubris, for campaigning under his nickname, for his southern accent, for being from the tiny town of Plains, Georgia, for his hick brother Billy, for his parody of a southern mother, Miss Lillian, and for just about everything else about him. When he won his party's nomination and then the election, the foreign press had a great time portraying Carter as Lil Abner. Carter himself, meanwhile, pursued with tremendous earnestness issues such as civil service reform. He went to a federal office building and told the workers there to go home and spend more time with their families. Carter's apparent bumbling of two crises during his presidency doomed his hopes for a second term. Or rather, those crises plus the arrival of Ronald Reagan doomed his hopes. First came the economy, and in particular, inflation. It was in the single digits when he entered office in 1977, and double digits when it peaked in 1980, by which time the voters were preparing to send him back to Plains. Carter will be remembered unfairly as the president who failed to deal with inflation. Actually, he is the hero of this episode. His predecessor, Gerald Ford, tried inane gimmicks like getting everybody to wear WIN buttons, WIN being short for Whip Inflation Now. That was moronic, but harmless. Carter's predecessor's predecessor, Richard Nixon, tried wage and price controls, which were moronic and extremely harmful. On his way to doing the right thing, Carter did something pretty moronic himself. He gave his famous malaise speech, in which the word malaise doesn't appear. The speech was interpreted, not completely unfairly, as accusing the voters of bearing the blame for their own problems. Actually, this accusation was completely fair. The voters were, and still are, largely to blame for their problems by making incompatible demands on their elected officials. Raise my benefits, cut my taxes, balance the budget, and then exploding with rage when those demands aren't met. But however true, this was not what the voters wanted to hear. To curb inflation, Carter did the one thing that was certain to work. He appointed Paul Volcker, a known hard money man, as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Volcker duly raised interest rates, slammed the brakes on the economy, and put it into a tough recession. When America got through it, the nation had a stable currency again. You could say Carter was not just the saga's hero, but its martyr. He sacrificed his presidency for the good of the country. He knew that a recession was the only certain way to rid the inflation in the nation, and he knew that the medicine comes before the cure. That is, things would have to get worse before they got better. In short, he knew that he would get the blame and his successor would get the credit, but he did it anyhow. The other big challenge Jimmy Carter is thought to have blown is the Iran hostage crisis. In November of 1979, a student protest in Tehran degenerated into a riot, which then degenerated into the seizure of the American embassy and more than 60 of its American occupants. The Iranians eventually set 13 people free. Over the next 14 months, the Carter administration negotiated the release of hostages. Tragically, the president ordered a daring rescue mission, which was epically botched, claiming the lives of 8 American servicemen. Nothing worked. The country felt humiliated. Finally and vindictively, the hostages, after 444 days of imprisonment, were released during Reagan's inauguration. In those days, people still thought dealing with terrorists was, or should be, an easy thing for the most powerful country in the world. That said, it is the post-presidential Carter, the common man turned commander-in-chief turned dedicated humanitarian, who would grow in stature year after year in the public mind. Even in his waning days, he was regarded as a model of poise, jointly moving into hospice, publicly and gracefully, 3 months before Rosalind, his life partner and soulmate, was revealed to have been battling dementia. Rosalind passed away in November 2023. As he approached his centenary, Jimmy Carter would tell his son Chip, "I'm only trying to make it to vote for Kamala Harris," reported the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Upon reaching that milestone in October 2024, he cast his ballot proudly. As with so much else in his life, it was a modest but virtuous goal. Another story from the current events section. New Orleans truck attack responsible for 15 deaths. FBI searches for accomplices. This is published on January 1st. A driver deliberately crashed his truck into a crowd of New Year's Day revelers on Bourbon Street in New Orleans and then opened fire, killing at least 15 people and injuring more than 35 in an attack the FBI said was investigating as an act of terrorism. "This is not just an act of terrorism, this is evil," Police Chief Ann Kirkpatrick said at a televised press conference on Wednesday. He was hell-bent on creating the carnage and the damage that he did. After driving his vehicle into crowds of people over a 3-block stretch in the French Quarter around 3:15 a.m. and firing shots into the crowd, the suspect got out of the pickup truck with an assault weapon and opened fire on 3 police officers, who returned fire and killed the driver. According to the FBI on Wednesday afternoon, the suspect was identified as 42-year-old Shamsuddin Jabbar, an Army veteran from Texas and a U.S. citizen, according to the New York Times. An ISIS flag and weapons were found in the rental vehicle. Surveillance video revealed 3 men and a woman placing an improvised explosive device in the area, according to the Associated Press, citing a Louisiana State Police intelligence bulletin. The Sugar Bowl, a college football game played in New Orleans each year on New Year's Day, was postponed until Thursday while police continued the investigation and checked the neighborhood for more clues. The city will also be the site of the NFL Super Bowl at the Caesars Superdome on February 9th, with Kendrick Lamar as the headliner for the halftime show. Alethea Duncan, assistant special agent in charge for the FBI in New Orleans, did not rule out that there could be an ongoing threat, saying that agents were running down leads to try to make sure that that was not the case. "We do not believe that Jabbar was solely responsible. We are aggressively running down every lead, including those of his known associates," said Duncan during a press conference. Public records show Jabbar worked in real estate in Houston, according to Reuters. In a promotional video posted 4 years ago, he described himself as born and raised in Beaumont, a city about 80 miles east of Houston, who spent 10 years in the U.S. military as a human resources and IT specialist. President Joe Biden called the city's mayor to offer full federal support, the White House said in a statement. The country woke up this morning to news of a terrible tragedy in New Orleans, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland said in a statement. He said federal law enforcement agencies would deploy every available resource to conduct this investigation. The New Year's Day attack follows a similar tragedy in Germany last month when a 50-year-old man was charged with multiple counts of murder and attempted murder after police said he plowed a car through crowds at a Christmas market in Magdeburg, killing 5 people and injuring scores. President-elect Donald Trump posted on social media that his incoming administration would fully support the city of New Orleans as they investigate and recover from this act of pure evil. We're going to move on to celebrity news. Kylie Kelce tells Joe Rogan fans exactly who the fuck she is and why she'll be all over their social feeds. This is by Casey Wickman, published on January 3rd. "It's that old adage burned into your brain after your mom said it to you a million times growing up. If you don't have anything nice to say, at least don't admit to the world that you don't know how to use Google." Kylie Kelce offered a refresher of this concept to the world, especially fans of podcast host Joe Rogan, who are salty about her dethroning him from the top-rated show slot on the latest episode of her show, Not Gonna Lie, released Thursday. Since her podcast debuted and began its back and forth at the top of the charts with the Joe Rogan Experience, Kelce has drawn the ire of conservatives, not just by besting Rogan in ratings, but by saying in a recent interview that her political views aggressively lean left. In the new episode, Kelce said, "Who the fuck is Kylie Kelce?" has emerged as a constant top search on social media. "I can't get over the fact that you actually typed this into Twitter when you could have typed it into Google," she said. "And also, you typed my name, so now you know what you're gonna get. More Kylie Kelce content." Kelce appeared bewildered at the lack of understanding of the internet and how the attention economy works. Engagement, whether positive or negative, is still engagement in the digital eyes of the internet. "A while ago, I had talked to my producers about, like, do we do, like, a segment on algorithms and explain to people that if you engage with the content and if you write my name and shit, you're just going to keep getting me on your timeline?" Another thing that Kelce said has blown my mind are the criticisms of her podcast as amateur. "I've been fucking saying that about my own podcast," she said, laughing. Kelce, who is married to former Philadelphia Eagles player Jason Kelce and is sister-in-law to current Kansas City Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce, debuted her weekly podcast in December. Next up, it ends with court. Blake Lively disputes false premise of Justin Baldani's $250 million New York Times libel suit. This is by Savannah Walsh, published on January 2nd. As the new year begins, a pair of lawsuits from former It Ends With Us collaborators Blake Lively and Justin Baldani are making waves across Hollywood. Baldani, director and co-lead of the big-screen adaptation of Colleen Hoover's 2016 bestseller, is suing The New York Times for libel and false light invasion of privacy over a December 21st article titled, "We Can Bury Anyone, Inside a Hollywood Smear Machine." The piece reported that Baldani sexually harassed Lively and then hired a crisis PR firm to enact a smear campaign against her. Lively initially filed a complaint against Baldani, his Wayfarer production company, and others allegedly involved in the smear campaign with California's Civil Rights Department. And on Tuesday, the day Baldani filed his $250 million libel suit against the Times, Lively filed a suit in New York federal court as well. The latest litigation arrives after previous rumors of discord between Lively and Baldani, who did not complete any joint press obligations during the August rollout for It Ends With Us. The film ultimately grossed more than $350 million worldwide. Conversations about the co-stars' relationship had quieted until about December, when the New York Times report came out. Detailing text messages and emails Lively's team had obtained via subpoena that appeared to show a coordinated plan to plant stories about Lively that would tarnish her reputation. In a written statement shared with media, including with Vanity Fair, Lively said, "I hope that my legal action helps pull back the curtain on the sinister retaliatory tactics to harm people who speak up about misconduct and helps protect others who may be targeted." Lively's claims focused on Baldani, as well as It Ends With Us producer Jamie Heath, Wayfarer Studio co-founder Steve Sarowitz, Baldani's publicist Jennifer Abel, and Melissa Nathan, the crisis PR manager Baldani hired as the film was being released. Those five are now suing The Times, claiming the idea that they orchestrated a retaliatory public relations campaign against Lively for speaking out about sexual harassment is categorically false and easily disproven, according to the suit filed in Los Angeles County Superior Court. As first reported by Variety on December 31st, Baldani's suit claims that The Times relied almost entirely on Lively's unverified and self-serving narrative, alleging that the digital correspondence the report quotes were cherry-picked and stripped of necessary context and deliberately spliced to mislead. The suit also accuses the outlet of not giving Baldani and his team sufficient time to respond to Lively's allegations ahead of the story's publication, which allegedly occurred nearly 2 hours earlier than expected and 14 hours after they were first contacted by the paper. "The role of an independent news organization is to follow the facts where they lead," a spokesperson for the New York Times said in a statement to the press. "Our story was meticulously and responsibly reported. It was based on a review of thousands of pages of original documents, including the text messages and emails that we quote accurately and at length in the article. We published their full statement in response to the allegations in the article as well. We plan to vigorously defend the lawsuit." In an email to Vanity Fair, a Times spokesperson disputed the claim that the newspaper did not provide a sufficient time to respond to the allegations and said that Baldani, Wayfarer, and the other subjects chose not to have any conversations with the Times or address any of the specific text messages or documents. After the Times story was published, Lively received public support from many key players in It Ends With Us, including author Colleen Hoover and co-stars Jenny Slate and Brandon Sklenar, as well as studio Sony Pictures, which said of Lively in a statement to Deadline, "We strongly condemn any reputational attacks on her." Baldani, meanwhile, has been dropped from the talent agency William Morris Endeavor, which also represents Lively and her husband Ryan Reynolds. In his suit, Baldani claims that Lively and Reynolds pressured the WME agent to drop the actor at the Deadpool and Wolverine premiere. In a statement to The Hollywood Reporter, WME denied that Baldani's former representative attended the event or that there was any pressure from Reynolds or Lively at any time to drop Baldani as a client. Baldani has denied Lively's claims of sexual harassment, including allegations that the studio ignored her request to have an intimacy coordinator present while shooting sexual scenes, and that Baldani made inappropriate comments on set and entered Lively's trailer without consent as she breastfed. In the suit, Baldani argues that he hired a crisis PR firm as a protective measure ahead of the film's premiere, claiming that Lively attempted to seize control of the movie during production before coordinating a strategic and manipulative smear campaign of her own. Nothing in this lawsuit changes anything about the claims advanced in Ms. Lively's California Civil Rights Department complaint, nor her federal complaint, filed earlier today. Attorneys for Lively said in a statement to the press, "This lawsuit is based on the obviously false premise that Ms. Lively's administrative complaint against Wayfarer and others was a ruse. While we will not litigate this matter in the press, we do encourage people to read Ms. Lively's complaint in its entirety. We look forward to addressing each and every one of Wayfarer's allegations in court." Vanity Fair has reached out to a representative for Lively for further comment. Checking in on the royals, King Charles gives iconic candy company the boot. This is by Eve Beatty on December 30th. Cadbury brand chocolates have borne an image of the royal arms for 170 years, but in recent days, King Charles III has ended that candy's reign. In a shakeup that surprised much of Britain, Charles has pulled Cadbury's royal warrant, an honor intended to indicate that the company is a supplier to England's ruling family. The brand, a favorite of Queen Victoria's, is now out in the cold, as is Unilever, the vast British conglomerate that owns companies including Ben & Jerry's ice cream, the Axe fragrance line, and self-proclaimed cosmetics cop Paula Bigone's skincare line. As Buckingham Palace explains, royal warrants, full name Royal Marks of Appointment, are a mark of recognition to people or companies who have regularly supplied goods or services to the royal household. It's a distinction granted to about 800 companies and makers from around the globe, giving them the right to display the royal family's coat of arms in relation to its business. Typically, you'll see it on packaging, a company website, or on its delivery vehicles. As you can imagine, strict rules exist about its display and use. But similar to a Michelin star, this isn't a lifetime approval. Warrants may not be renewed if the quality or supply for the product or service is insufficient, Buckingham Palace notes, and it may be canceled at any time and is automatically reviewed if the grantee dies or leaves the business, or if the firm goes bankrupt or is sold. It's unclear how Cadbury ran afoul of King Charles, who announced the second set of warrants earlier this month after his coronation in 2023. Conspicuous in its absence from the list, which can be read in full online, were Cadbury, which was first granted its warrant in 1854, and Unilever, a warrant holder since 2016. Both Unilever and Cadbury's parent company, Chicago-based Mondelez International, have been the focus of boycotts and ban campaigns in recent years over the company's business ties with Russia following its invasion of Ukraine. Groups including the International Partnership for Human Rights sent an open letter to Charles this summer asking specifically that he revoke the royal warrants from all warrant-holding companies that are continuing their operations in Russia, as doing so would show that the companies contributing to the suffering and devastation in Ukraine will not be bestowed with the privilege and honor of holding a royal warrant. According to The Independent, the issue might be less about politics and more about the planet. Charles is known as an environmental crusader and a fan of organic and sustainable food, both interests that seem at odds with multinational corporations focused on ultra-processed foods. That might be why, as the paper puts it, the supply of Cadbury products to royal households has decreased in recent years. The late Queen Elizabeth, we should note, was known as a fan of the company's Bourneville dark chocolate bar. Speaking with the BBC, Birmingham Business School professor David Bailey notes that being dropped from the list isn't just a status thing and can have a real impact on a company's bottom line. Costs following the change will include redesigns for packaging to remove the insignia from all goods, as well as across-the-board revisions to advertising and marketing materials. Via statement, Unilever said it is very proud of the long history our brands have supplying the royal household and of the warrants they have been awarded during this time, most recently by Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, but did not respond to questions regarding its business in Russia. Mondelez's response on behalf of Cadbury was slightly more pointed. Whilst we are disappointed to be one of hundreds of other businesses and brands in the UK to not have a new warrant awarded, we are proud to have previously held one, and we fully respect the decision. In other royal news, Meghan Markle's reality TV show With Love, Meghan premieres January 15th on Netflix. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on January 2nd. For nearly a year, Meghan Markle has been teasing a return to the type of lifestyle media she once posted as a food and travel blogger on her now-shuttered website, The Tig. On Thursday, the Duchess of Sussex announced that her show will be called With Love, Meghan, and will premiere on January 15th. "I have been so excited to share this with you," the Duchess said. "I hope you love the show as much as I loved making it. Wish you all a fantastic new year." Last year, the streamer revealed that Megan was working on her show with Leah Harriton, who served as showrunner for Selena Gomez's cooking show, Selena and Chef. A trailer posted to the Instagram account Megan shared on January 1st, the Duchess dons an apron in the kitchen, wanders in a garden, visits a flower shop, and wears beekeeper garb and more to the tune of the 1965 hit Do You Believe in Magic by the Lovin' Spoonful. I've always believed in taking something ordinary and elevating it and surprising people with moments to let them know I was thinking about them, Megan says in a trailer voiceover. I'm going to share some little tips and tricks. The trailer also includes a brief cameo from her husband, Prince Harry, and two of their dogs, along with scenes featuring Meghan's former Suits co-star, Abigail Spencer, makeup artist Daniel Martin, literary agent and bookstore owner Jennifer Rudolph Walsh, actor Mindy Kaling, LA-based chef Roy Choi. According to Netflix, restaurateur and cookbook author Alice Waters will also be a guest on the show, which was filmed mainly in Montecito, the small Santa Barbara enclave where Meghan and Harry live with their two children, Prince Archie and Princess Lilibet. The first sign that Meghan was planning her official return to lifestyle media came in March 2024, when she made a website for American Riviera Orchard. Though samples of the brand's strawberry jam went out to a handful of Meghan's friends, the brand's official launch has been delayed due in part to copyright issues and reportedly a desire to launch alongside the Netflix show. We are going to transition into the politics section. This article was written last week, but it is still being talked about in the news. The headline reads, Luigi Mangione isn't solely responsible for UnitedHealthcare CEO's death, poll respondents claim. Participants in a nonpartisan survey say insurance denials and company profits bear a moderate amount of responsibility for Bob Thompson's brazen shooting in New York City. This is by Eve Beatty on December 27th. It's no secret that the slaying of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, allegedly by 26-year-old Luigi Mangione, unleashed a tidal of rage against the deeply problematic U.S. healthcare system. But according to a new poll, frustration with the industry is so serious that many Americans believe that Mangione wasn't solely responsible for Thompson's death and that the insurance industry played a significant role. To be clear, we're not talking here about social media conspiracies about the shooting, such as those linking Luigi Mangione's Pokemon of choice, Breloom, of course, with insurance claim denial codes. Pollsters at the nonpartisan research organization NORC at the University of Chicago interviewed 1,001 adults between December 12th and 16th, asking them first about their familiarity with the case. Of those, 39% they had heard a lot, while an improbable 9% said they'd heard nothing at all. Of those, about 8 in 10 said that they believed that Mangione had either a great deal or a moderate amount culpability in Thompson's death, but 7 in 10 also believed that insurance company coverage denials, such as UnitedHealthcare's AI-generated rejections, bear a moderate amount of responsibility for the homicide. Insurance company profits, such as UnitedHealthcare's $371.6 billion in 2023, were also cited by respondents as responsible for the fatal shooting. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are currently reading an article from vanityfair.com about Luigi Mangione. Let's continue. As expected, Mangione was extradited from a Pennsylvania jail on December 19th and was transported to New York to face charges of including first-degree murder in furtherance of terrorism. He appeared in Manhattan criminal court on Monday and pleaded not guilty to all charges. A crowd of protesters stood outside during the proceedings, many with signs bearing slogans critical of UnitedHealthcare and other large insurance companies, a scene that certainly underscores the sentiments of the poll takers. During the hearing, defense attorney Karen Friedman Agnifilo expressed concerns about Mangione's ability to get a fair trial, citing his well-documented arrival in New York. Quote, he was on display for everyone to see in the biggest staged perp walk I've ever seen in my career, the former prosecutor said. It was absolutely unnecessary. He's been cooperative with law enforcement. He's been in custody for over a week. He waived extradition. He's not a symbol. He's somebody who's afforded the right to a fair trial. He's innocent until proven guilty. And the mayor was talking to jurors, future potential jurors. Those are the people that elected him that he's talking to and calling this man a terrorist. I just want to make a record of this and put everyone on notice that this has to stop, and my client is entitled to a fair trial and the presumption of innocence. As he awaits trial, Mangione is expected to remain at Brooklyn's Metropolitan Detention Center, the same holding cell that Sean Diddy Combs and many other suspects during court proceedings. According to experts who spoke with Gothamist, Mangione is likely a resident of a 21-person special unit called 4N, where he remains separated from the general population. He's expected to return to court on February 21st, 2025. We are now moving full into the politics section. This first headline, Donald Trump can't torch all of Joe Biden's legacy. The president-elect may be hell-bent on reversing his predecessor's policies, but some of Biden's biggest wins on everything from clean energy to infrastructure and Ukraine aid may be Trump-proof. This is by Chris Smith on January 3rd. Senator Chris Coons was speaking quickly. He needed to get to the Senate floor to confirm the last batch of President Joe Biden's judicial nominees, adding to the largest number of appointments in a four-year term since the Carter administration. It's not just going to be a record number. It's going to be a broad, diverse, experienced, qualified, younger federal judiciary, hundreds of judges at the circuit court, district court, and Supreme Court level, Coons tells me. These are lifetime appointments. Joe Biden's legacy in the federal judiciary will last for a generation. But at the moment, Biden's weightiest legacy appears to be an awful one, a disastrous final year in office that helped return Donald Trump to the White House. Last summer, as Biden clung to his party's nomination, a senior Democratic strategist described to me, presciently, the stakes of the president's sticking it out. Everything will be seen as his fault. Every Senate seat lost, every House seat lost, every right that Trump takes away, you own everything. Biden finally quit the race, of course, but not until late July. The timing, coupled with his wide and deep unpopularity, helped put the Democrats in a deep political hole from which Kamala Harris did not climb out. And now, Trump will try to tear up many of the good things Biden did during his term. The former and future president spent a great deal of time on the 2024 campaign trail vowing to reverse Biden's policies and positions on everything from transgender rights to immigration restrictions. Trump might also attempt to undo regulatory changes made during the final 60 days of Biden's presidency. Yet, for all the fulminating that may or may not turn into action, and for all the real damage Trump is sure to inflict, there are major Biden accomplishments that are Trump-proof. Three deserve particular recognition because they will have an impact, to varying degrees, on existential issues. Most starkly, instead of engaging in isolationist posturing and weird sycophancy toward Vladimir Putin, the U.S. pushed back aggressively against the Russian invasion of Ukraine, organizing international resistance and sending billions in American aid. Could Biden have defended Ukraine even more forcefully? Perhaps. I think the piecemealing of sending weapon systems became a real obstacle to greater Ukrainian success, says Michael Allen, a White House national security specialist under former President George W. Bush. Then again, the risks of escalation, especially considering Russia's nuclear arsenal, made a gradual approach prudent. Ukraine remains an independent nation, and thousands of its citizens are alive today because Biden was president for the past 4 years. Buying them that time has real value, including the chance of a negotiated ceasefire, even if Ukraine's next 4 years turn out to be bleak. The situation in Ukraine is certainly desperate, says Ivo Dalder, a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. But let's also look at the other side of the ledger. The Russian army has been destroyed, literally destroyed. NATO has been strengthened significantly. There's no doubt in my mind that the world is a better place today because of Biden than it would have been under Trump. Closer to home, though also of global importance, was Biden's successful 2022 battle to pass a signature piece of legislation. Its name, the Inflation Reduction Act, was a bit of political spin. True, the IRA included meaningful health care and tax policy changes designed to bring down costs, but the bill's core was devoted to climate change. It pumped hundreds of billions of dollars in government subsidies into clean energy and climate programs and sparked a wave of private investments by offering billions in tax credits. Trump regularly rails against the climate change provisions of the IRA, and he may be able to cancel some of its mechanisms, but there's no clawing back the cash that has already flowed into green energy projects. The benefits will be felt across the country. Together with the CHIPS and Science Act that's resulted in almost $1 trillion in public and private sector investment, says Gina McCarthy, who was Biden's first White House national climate advisor, it wasn't spent to deny fossil fuels. It was spent to recognize that a clean energy economy would be enormously beneficial, not just for the climate, but for getting people good jobs. It was designed as a 10-year horizon, and in 3 years, we are far, far exceeding expectations. New technologies for manufacturing plants, new batteries to power energy, ground source heat pumps, electric vehicles. The place where it will be least possible for Trump to turn back the clock is, fittingly and ironically, the place where Biden is least likely to receive credit. The president's infrastructure push has built or rebuilt roads, bridges, sewer systems, and railroad projects from coast to coast. Way back in 2014, when he was a mere vice president, Biden said LaGuardia Airport seemed more suited to some third world country than to New York City. New York's governor at the time, Andrew Cuomo, spearheaded the renovation plans, but Biden's Infrastructure Act has allocated more than $113 million to boost the airport overhaul. Meanwhile, a makeover is also underway for the eternal snarl of I-95 south of the Delaware Memorial Bridge, which is personal for Coons, who occupies the Delaware Senate seat Biden held for 35 years. The interchange is nearing completion, he says, and it will dramatically improve development in the area and reduce the huge air quality and health impacts from traffic. Do all of these multiple unsexy victories on foreign policy, climate change, and infrastructure outweigh the implications of Harris's high-profile defeat, particularly if Trump enables a national abortion ban or constructs mass detention camps? Probably not. But some of the gains, achieved by a man who served his country honorably for decades and is about to leave the White House, will last beyond his administration. Someone should at least name an airport, a rail line, or a stretch of interstate after him. Our next headline, Donald Trump muddies the waters in New Orleans. The president-elect's open border rants in response to a deadly truck attack allegedly perpetrated by a U.S. citizen is an ominous sign for his second term. This is by Eric Lutz on January 3rd. Donald Trump wasted little time this week trying to use the deadly New Year's attack in New Orleans as an opportunity to push his hardline border policies, even though the suspected killer, Shamsuddin Jabbar, was a United States-born citizen from Texas. When I said that the criminals coming in are far worse than the criminals we have in our country, that statement was constantly refuted by Democrats and the fake news media. Trump wrote on Truth Social Wednesday, when details about the truck attack that killed 15 and injured dozens of others in the French Quarter were still sparse, but it turned out to be true. The crime rate in our country is at a level that nobody has ever seen before, Trump added. The implication is that the alleged attacker, a 42-year-old Army veteran who appears to have been inspired by ISIS, but authorities say acted alone, was from outside the U.S. is false, as even Fox News pointed out. But Trump continued to push this narrative Thursday. This is what happens when you have open borders with weak, ineffective, and virtually non-existent leadership, Trump posted. With the Biden open borders policy, I said many times during rallies and elsewhere, that radical Islamic terrorism and other forms of violent crime will become so bad in America that it will become hard to even imagine or believe. His MAGA allies followed suit, blaming Democratic immigration policy for the homegrown attack. Our open border, our America Last legal immigration system, and Congress's inaction have created the perfect storm to endanger Americans in a multitude of ways, Arizona Congressman Eli Crane wrote. With weak policies that put the safety of Americans last, it's not a question of if, but when. Trump, of course, has always been a fire hose of lies, distortions, and other bullshit, spouting falsehoods that serve his political agenda. But in just over 2 weeks, he'll once again be spouting them from the most powerful office in the country, where his words will have a far broader reach and carry greater significance. His disinformation has been bad enough on its own, corrosive to our civic life and a danger to our democracy. But Trump's indifference to reality and susceptibility to bunk are particularly dangerous in moments of crisis, as we saw at the onset of the COVID pandemic during the final year of his first term. Trump's opportunism following the New Orleans terror attack is a reminder of that chaos and confusion, and a preview of what's in store when he takes office again later this month. This is also a story from last week. Donald Trump urges the Supreme Court to pause the TikTok ban decision until after inauguration. This is by Katie Hirchenroder. President-elect Donald Trump's legal team asked the Supreme Court to halt a law requiring TikTok to be sold to an American company or shut down by January 19th, the day before his inauguration. In a petition filed on Friday, the legal team argued that the incoming president should have the opportunity to resolve the issues at hand through political means once he takes office. While the brief did not directly address the legal question at hand, whether banning the platform for the some 170 million Americans who use it violates their First Amendment rights to free speech, it noted that at this juncture, Trump opposes banning TikTok in the United States. The Supreme Court agreed to hear the case earlier this month after a bipartisan measure, the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act, passed Congress and was signed into law by President Joe Biden. The law cites national security concerns and would require TikTok's Chinese owner, ByteDance, to either sell to an American company or face a ban. President Trump alone possesses the consummate deal-making expertise, the electoral mandate, and the political will to negotiate a resolution to save the platform while addressing the national security concerns expressed by the government, concerns which President Trump himself has acknowledged. The brief, signed by Trump's counsel and his pick for U.S. Solicitor General, D. John Sauer, reads, "The TikTok's legal team and the Biden administration also submitted briefs for the court to consider in the weeks leading up to oral arguments on January 10th. TikTok argued that Congress signing the law was an unprecedented attempt to single out petitioners and bar them from operating one of the nation's most significant speech venues and was profoundly unconstitutional. They added that the government has banned an extraordinary amount of speech and gets facts wrong when it bothers to provide them. The Biden administration held that the law addresses the serious threats to national security posed by the Chinese government's control of TikTok, a platform that harvests sensitive data about tens of millions of Americans and would be a potent tool for covert influence operations by a foreign adversary. Another brief, filed on behalf of users of the service, acknowledged the ongoing geopolitical tension between U.S. and China, yet argued that allowing the law to take effect amounts to a suppression of Americans' speech and flies in the face of our history, tradition, and precedent. Trump's more recent support for the application is a shift from when, while still president in 2020, he unsuccessfully attempted to ban the platform, citing national security concerns. Federal courts halted his efforts. Despite expressing disdain for the Chinese-owned app, he isn't the only government leader who has used it to reach voters and campaign. According to an analysis by NBC News, 23 members of Congress who voted for the TikTok ban have verified accounts, and many of them use the platform to campaign, defend their beliefs, and curate their public image, even as they argue that the app poses a threat to American users. As Vanity Fair's Gabriel Sherman reported in March, Trump's shift could be influenced by his complicated relationship with billionaire and mega donor Jeff Yass. Yass, via Susquehanna International Group, put a few million dollars into ByteDance in 2012, an investment now worth some $40 billion, according to the Financial Times. The billionaire had previously urged Trump not to run and donated millions of dollars to his primary opponents, but with the former president's electoral popularity and the growing threats to TikTok, Yass invited Trump to speak at a Club for Growth donor retreat at the Breakers in Palm Beach in March. In June, Trump's tone shift toward TikTok was evident when he posted his first video on the platform, a 13-second clip filmed at an Ultimate Fighting Championship event in Newark, New Jersey. Within a day, he had amassed millions of followers. Trump, his team argued to the Supreme Court on Friday, is uniquely poised to handle this issue because of his history with social media. President Trump is one of the most powerful, prolific, and influential users of social media in history, the brief said. Consistent with his commanding presence in this area, President Trump currently has 14.7 million followers on TikTok with whom he actively communicates, allowing him to evaluate TikTok's importance as a unique medium for freedom of expression, including core political speech. Trump has used his TikTok account to, amongst other things, encourage his supporters to stay in line on Election Day, share videos of him with YouTube star Logan Paul and his brother, professional boxer and influencer Jake Paul, promote his campaign stunt of working at a McDonald's, and post supercuts of his hate-filled rally in Madison Square Garden. Our next headline, Mike Johnson cinches House Speaker role in one vote after Trump phoned naysayers. The lower chamber quickly voted to make it harder to oust the speaker moving forward. Yet, Johnson still faces an uphill battle. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on January 4th. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson held onto his job on Friday, securing enough votes from his Republican colleagues to be reelected in one round. It's an abbreviated journey for Johnson compared to the 15 rounds that his predecessor, Kevin McCarthy, endured to become speaker. What we're proposing now is just simply, as President Trump likes to say, a return to common sense. And he's exactly right, Johnson said in his acceptance speech in front of the 119th Congress. In his address, he promised to go after illegal aliens, bolster the military, and give more power to parents to define their children's education, amongst other goals. I am very thankful, personally, that this body is filled with men and women who are committed to that change, to return to common sense. We can do this together. We should. Johnson's win comes after a coordinated push from President-elect Donald Trump and his allies to secure a vote in the incumbent's favor. In late December, Trump endorsed Johnson for the role, referring to him as a good, hardworking, religious man in a Truth Social post that included references to Beyonce, Reverend Al Sharpton, and unsubstantiated claims of large-scale voter fraud in the 2024 election. Trump celebrated Johnson's Friday win on Truth Social, too, writing that Mike will be a great speaker and our country will be the beneficiary. Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky was the only Republican who voted against Johnson in the final tally. Though initially 9 Republicans abstained or voted against Johnson, one by one they changed their votes. Along with Massie, 2 other Republican members still weren't sure, Representatives Ralph Norman of South Carolina and Keith Self of Texas. For almost an hour, as Real Clear Politics reported, those 2 Republicans seemed like they were about to hamstring the leader of their own conference. When a second ballot seemed imminent, South Carolina Rep. Nancy Mace dialed the president-elect on her cell phone. According to a source with direct knowledge of the call, Trump told the pair they were being ridiculous. "I won all these swing states, but while Democrats are over there sticking together, you 2 guys are screwing it all up. The American people want relief and the Trump agenda," the president-elect reportedly told the representatives. "You 2 are screwing it all up." In an interview with Fox News on Friday, Norman explained that he had doubted Johnson because he wasn't convinced he had the oomph or the willingness to fight for Trump's agenda. "I said, Mike, are you going to give us specific examples of fighting for the things we mentioned? Will you give us your word?" He said yes, so I said, "Okay, we'll take you at your word. That's why I changed my vote," Norman said, adding, "He's going to have Trump backing him up, which is all a good thing." After the Friday vote, Johnson said that there were no deals cut to secure the gavel and that he hadn't done that in 14 months as speaker and he wasn't about to start today. "I've been aiming to decentralize the speaker's office power since I first had the gavel. We'll continue that," the speaker told reporters. Johnson also took the time to praise Trump as the most powerful president, certainly of the modern era, maybe in all of American history, adding that his endorsement was a big factor in this. When asked if he plans to helm the House for the next 2 years, he said 100% yes. Johnson received another win when, following his re-election, House Republicans signed off on a new rules package that raises the threshold to force a vote on ousting the Speaker. Previously, a single lawmaker could trigger a motion to remove the Speaker. Now, any motion to remove Johnson requires at least 9 members from the majority party, a shift that Democrats will say will allow Republicans to shield the Speaker from bipartisan accountability. Still, Johnson is likely to face an uphill battle as Speaker, a reality he's already gotten a taste of since Trump retook the presidency in November. When Trump and billionaire ally Elon Musk pushed back on Johnson's government spending bill in December, the Speaker was forced to quickly rework the legislation to avoid a government shutdown and keep the team happy. In the hours after Johnson won re-election, 11 members of the House Freedom Caucus penned a letter to their GOP colleagues detailing what they think Johnson ought to do moving forward. The letter was signed by Representative Chip Roy, a Republican from Texas who threatened a mutiny against Johnson earlier this week, but was reportedly told by Trump, "You've got to be with me." Roy told Politico reporters that the caucus's goals better damn well happen. When asked what would happen to Johnson if he didn't live up to their expectations, the Texas representative replied, "Use your imagination." We're going to end where we began. Global leaders mourn the death of Jimmy Carter. This is by Katie Hirschenberger. Leaders around the world are mourning the death of former President Jimmy Carter, who died Sunday at his home in Georgia. He was 100 years old, the oldest living U.S. president ever. Carter, the only president to hail from Georgia and the first president to be inaugurated under a nickname, he was born James Earl Carter Jr., is remembered as a champion of global peace, a truth teller from humble beginnings, and a committed public leader before, during, and after his time serving as the 39th president of the United States. The former president will receive a state funeral at Washington National Cathedral on January 9th, the culmination of more than a week of ceremonies and honors. President Joe Biden, who was the first senator and first politician outside of Georgia to endorse Carter in his bid for the White House, will read a eulogy. U.S. flags are to fly at half-staff, per the direction of Biden, at the White House and on public buildings and grounds, military posts, naval stations, and naval vessels across the U.S. and its territories for 30 days, including on Inauguration Day. Biden designated January 9th as a national day of mourning. Stock exchanges will be closed that day. Carter will be interred next to his wife of 77 years, the former First Lady Rosalynn Carter, who died in November of 2023 in a family plot next to a willow tree at the edge of a pond in Plains, Georgia, where they lived together for most of their lives. As soon as his son, James E. Carter III, announced his father's passing, leaders around the world began paying tribute to Jimmy Carter, who, through his diplomatic work in and out of office, uniquely altered the course of global affairs. First is President Joe Biden. "Today, America and the world lost an extraordinary leader, statesman, and humanitarian," President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden wrote in a statement. "With his compassion and moral clarity, he worked to eradicate disease, forge peace, advance civil rights and human rights, promote free and fair elections, house the homeless, and always advocate for the least among us. He saved, lifted, and changed the lives of people all across the globe." Vice President Kamala Harris. "Jimmy Carter," Kamala Harris wrote, "reminded our nation and the world that there is strength in decency and compassion. I had the privilege of knowing President Carter for years. I will always remember his kindness, wisdom, and profound grace. His life and legacy continue to inspire me and will inspire generations to come. Our world is a better place because of President Carter." Before his death, Carter told his son Chip, "I'm only trying to make it to vote for Kamala Harris," according to reporting from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. In October 2024, he cast his last vote via absentee ballot. Former President Barack Obama. Elected in the shadow of Watergate, Jimmy Carter promised voters that he would always tell the truth, and he did, advocating for the public good, consequences be damned. Former President Barack Obama wrote in a statement on Medium. He believed some things were more important than re-election, things like integrity, respect, and compassion. Marantha Baptist Church will be a little quieter on Sundays, but President Carter will never be far away. Buried alongside Rosalind next to a willow tree down the road, his memory calling all of us to heed our better angels. He continued, sharing anecdotes of Carter's teaching Sunday school at the Plains, Georgia church. Former President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Hillary and I mourn the passing of President Jimmy Carter and give thanks for his lifelong good life. Guided by his faith, President Carter lived to serve others until the very end, Bill Clinton wrote, adding, Hillary and I met President Carter in 1975 and were proud early supporters of his presidential campaign. I will always be proud to have presented the Medal of Freedom to him and Rosalind in 1999 and to have worked with him in the years after he left the White House. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. President Carter's faith in the American people and his belief in the power of kindness and humility leave a strong legacy. He taught us that the strength of a leader lies not in rhetoric, but in action, not in personal gain, but in service to others. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, wrote in a Sunday statement praising Carter's work with Habitat for Humanity. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. As president, his work to restore integrity to the political arena during a difficult chapter in our history was a testament to his firm faith in the sanctity of the public good, which he always placed above his own. Representative Nancy Pelosi wrote, adding, President Carter's love for his wife, First Lady Rosalind Carter, is immortal. Their beautiful bond and partnership in service were a wonder to behold. May it be a comfort to their children, Jack, Chip, Jeff, and Amy, and the entire Carter family that so many mourn their loss and are praying for them at this sad time. Georgia leaders. President Carter was one of my heroes, Reverend Raphael Warnock, a U.S. Senator from Georgia, wrote on Sunday. I'm honored to have had the opportunity to know President Carter, the first president I remember from my childhood and someone with whom I developed a meaningful friendship. He brought his family to worship at my church. At a family dinner, I remember the president and his amazing wife, Rosalind, holding my daughter, then just 2 months old, as if she were their own granddaughter. They were among my favorite people. Senator John Ossoff of Georgia also paid tribute to Carter, writing, From Plains to across the state of Georgia, the United States, and around the world, millions will forever admire and appreciate all that President Carter did for the United States and for the global community. As the only American president thus far to come from Georgia, he showed the world the impact our state and its people have on the country, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp said in a statement. That's all we have time for here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week for a full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. Once again, Happy New Year, and have a great week, everybody.